her hand. "No comment," I said, my voice wobbly and unsteady. I raced up the steps and let myself inside, black dots dancing across my vision from the flashbulbs. Exhaustion swept over me, and I leaned against the door. The voice is now muted to a dull mumble. Finally, I staggered to my feet. I needed a distraction from the creeping anxiety threatening to overwhelm me. I went into the kitchen and pulled a bottle of vodka from the freezer. I poured a finger into a glass and swallowed it fast. It burned, but I poured another and took it upstairs to Olivia's room. I snapped on the light. It was still messy, like an explosion in a clothes factory. It smelled of lemony shampoo and dirty socks. Her blankets trailed off the bed. I set the glass of vodka on Olivia's dresser and draped the blankets neatly over the bed, then sat on the edge. Something on her bedside table caught the afternoon light. Olivia's cell phone. It was attached to a charging cord, but when I picked it up, the plug dropped out. The battery was dead. The sound of a knock at the front door startled me. I slipped Olivia's phone into my hoodie pocket as I went downstairs. I looked through the peephole, expecting it to be a reporter, but instead it was a tall, broad-shouldered teenager wearing a wrinkled blue shirt halfway untucked from his jeans. His fair hair was disheveled, his hazel eyes so raw and swollen I almost didn't recognize him. The football build of Olivia's boyfriend looked like it had been put through the washing machine and shrunk. I took in his red eyes, the dark circles, the tear tracks trailing his putty-colored cheeks, and felt a swell of compassion. This inexorable tide of grief was his as well. It was something we shared. I opened the door, and flashbulbs instantly started popping, reporters shouting questions. I ignored them, pulling Tyler inside. Word traveled fast in a town as small as Portage Point, and it looked like every major Seattle media outlet was on this story.
"Is it true, what they're saying about Olivia?" he asked.
"Yes." I pressed my fists into my eyes. "There was an accident." Tyler swayed on his feet. I grabbed his elbow and directed him to a chair at the kitchen table, pressed a glass of water into his hands. He gulped it down.
"An accident?" he echoed.
"I don't know. The police, I have to report it."
"What happened?" he asked thickly.
"Nobody knows. She might have fallen off the bridge, but..." I hesitated, unsure if I should share my suspicions. "Did she leave the barbecue with anyone?"
"No, she was by herself."
"Madison didn't drive her?"
"I'm pretty sure she walked." Olivia knew she wasn't allowed to walk home alone in the dark. It was a firm rule of mine, one she'd never broken before.
"What time was that?"
"Like 10:30, maybe more like 10:45.
"Tyler, there's something I need to tell you." He stared at me, waited. "Olivia's pregnant." His arms dropped to the sides of the chair, heavy and limp. He looked like I'd punched him in the stomach. "Did you know?" I needed information. Anything he could tell me mattered intensely. He swallowed, then balled his hands into fists and stood. He turned away from me and hunched his shoulders.
"Tyler?"
I walked to him, touched his back with my fingertips. "I promise I won't be mad. Did you know she was pregnant?" The muscles under his shirt jumped, and he pulled away from my touch. When he finally looked at me, his eyes were wide, the whites dominating his face.
"I'm sorry, Miss Knight. There's no way that baby's mine."
Chapter 6. Abby. October. "I don't understand," I said. Fear crept over me, sliding along every muscle and bone as a new realization settled over me. Maybe I didn't know my daughter at all. "How?"
I asked Tyler. How do you... I know it's not mine. He cut me off, his voice rough, because Olivia and I never... He looked away. I pressed my fingers hard into my eyeballs, stars exploding on the undersides of my lids. The vodka I'd gulped earlier burned bitterly in my empty stomach. You never had sex. Right. Olivia was cheating on her boyfriend. It explained so much. She'd been so different lately, distant. I had a sudden memory of her at the Stokes' annual neighborhood barbecue. I'd arrived late. Work, a handy excuse. It wasn't that I didn't like people, just that I didn't really have anything interesting to talk about. Once I'd ticked off Olivia's achievements, the conversation went stale. Besides, I was really more of an observer than a participator. I was better at standing on the sidelines. Jen Stokes had opened the door, a glass of champagne in each hand and a wide smile on her lips. Her dark corkscrew curls bounced around a heart-shaped face. Hi, Jen. I smiled hard, the muscles in my jaw twinging painfully. Jen and I had known each other since the girls were five. Even after all this time, we were friendly, but not friends. Truth be told, Jen intimidated the hell out of me. Standing next to her made any bravado I had disappear, as if it had been sucked into the black hole of her self-confidence. She reminded me of what it was like being in junior high and high school. Back then, I was an outcast, the girl whose mom committed suicide. Nobody knew what to say to me, nor I to them. I never wore the right clothes or had the right hair or makeup. I spent lunch alone in a corner of the cafeteria, was never picked for teams in PE, was the last to get a partner for school projects. My teenage years were even worse, lonely until I developed breasts and learned to use my looks to get guys to like me. As I got older, I learned I was perfectly fine on my own. In fact, I preferred it that way. I didn't need any better friend than my daughter. Abby, so glad you could make it. Jen leaned in and kissed me on the cheek, then handed me a glass of champagne. I took a tiny sip. It was sweet and crisp, obviously expensive. How are you? I asked. My voice was too quiet, lost in the chatter of people inside, so I said it again. How've you been? Oh, you know, kids, work, life. She rolled her eyes and laughed dryly. But I knew she loved it. Jen was an ER doctor. She thrived under pressure. I followed Jen through her tastefully decorated living room, my feet sinking into thick, oatmeal-colored carpet. We exited the back door to a sprawling deck that overlooked a shade-dappled yard. A shimmering, rectangular swimming pool glinted in the waning light. The rich scent of barbecued ribs and burgers wafted up toward me. "Have you seen Olivia?" Jen asked. Something in her voice made me look up sharply. I felt my face freeze, determined not to show that her words sent a gush of worry flooding through my veins. "No," I said slowly. "Why?" "Oh, no reason." Her eyes skated sideways, and she set her glass on a table. "I'm going to grab you a plate of food, then we can catch up. Here." She turned to a leggy blonde woman wearing a short sunset-colored caftan and high canvas wedges and pulled her over to me. "Marie, this is Abby. Abby, Marie Corbin." Before I had a chance to reply, Jen had headed down the stairs and disappeared into the crowd. I frowned, feeling inexplicably abandoned. I tidied a few loose strands of hair behind my ears. Marie was gorgeous, and I felt my shoulders round as nerves pinched my stomach. She smiled at me, her sapphire eyes crinkling, her blonde hair a sleek mane, perfectly framing an angular face. "Oh, Abby, yes, I remember you. You're Olivia's mom." I forced a smile. I was going to say an accountant at Brown Thomas and Associates. You did the books for my new interior design company, and I was so pleased at how quickly you got them done.
Oh, I said, startled. Usually people only knew me as Olivia's mom, the mother of the rising star of the swim team. I tried to think of the last time I was anything else, and couldn't. I'm glad to hear it.
Across the yard, Jen's husband, Mark, raised a hand in greeting. Mark was a square-jawed business type, handsome in an aging frat boy sort of way. I waved back.
I'll just go say hi. I pointed at Mark, glad for an excuse to leave. Nice to meet you.
I went downstairs, grabbed a Coke from an ice bucket, and huddled next to a tall shrub in the corner of the backyard. If Sarah were here, she'd push me to go talk to people. She said I used work and Olivia as bricks in a wall I'd built around myself. Sarah was always right, and she did everything in the proper order. She'd finished college with a degree in psychology, then got a job, then a husband, a kid, and so on. Now she was a counselor for victims of traumatic cases. Most of her clients were referred from the Seattle Police Department. I was a wrecking ball in comparison, a single mom with a job I'd settled for and no real friends. Just then, something cold splashed against my arm.
Hi, Abby.
Derek, hi. Mark and Jen's son used to call me Miss Knight. I remembered when he was a chubby-cheeked second grader with perpetually grass-stained knees, and now here he was, calling me by my first name. I suddenly felt rather old. He grinned sheepishly.
Sorry about that.
I brushed the liquid from my arm.
When did you get old enough to drink? I teased.
I'm 19 now, Derek said, proud in that way teenagers get when they think they're all grown up. I smiled fondly at him.
Have you seen Olivia?
His smile faded.
No. Why? Is she in some sort of trouble?
No. I laughed at the thought. Olivia never got in trouble. Nothing like that. We were planning to meet here.
Oh.
He ran a hand over his jaw, and I noticed how much he looked like his mother. He had the same intense beauty, shaggy dark curls, a narrow, heart-shaped face. His dark blue eyes were piercing and intelligent. He was a good-looking kid, probably already breaking hearts. Somebody, a young woman, came up next to him then, touched his shoulder. He glanced at her, then at me, then stepped back. The entire exchange probably only lasted seconds, but it took me all that time to realize that the young woman next to him was Olivia. My brain felt like it was spinning in mud. Her long, silky blonde locks were gone, cropped into a pink-streaked pixie cut. Gone also were her usual t-shirt and jeans, replaced with black leggings and a low-cut peasant top that plunged into her cleavage. I remember looking at Olivia in the fading evening light and feeling like I didn't know her anymore. I knew then that something had been shaken loose, something I had no power to put back together. "Whose baby is it?" I asked Tyler now, my insides tight as a fist. He didn't answer. He looked very far away. "Tyler, whose baby is it?" He didn't look at me, didn't answer. Instead, he said,
"I wish I could have saved her."
Saved her from what?
His eyes crashed into mine.
From everything.
Chapter 7. Olivia. April. After dinner, Mom went upstairs to take a shower. The house still smelled of burned bread, even though all the windows were cracked open. It clawed at my throat and seared my nose, making me feel sick. As soon as I heard the shower turn on, I ran to the desk in the corner of the living room and shuffled through the neatly organized paperwork and alphabetized color-coded files. Nothing there. I took the stairs two at a time to Mom's bedroom. I pushed through electric cords and notebooks in her bedside table drawers. I dropped to my knees and checked under her bed. Just a scattering of dusty, mismatched hand weights, random books that didn't fit on the bookshelf downstairs, a box with cards and notes I'd given her. Obviously, I'd been in Mom's room loads of times, but I wasn't a weirdo. I'd never searched through her personal things. It felt gross. Disgust slithered up my throat, but then I remembered her lie. Those brown eyes. There must be some proof somewhere about who my father was. The minutes crawled by. I was running out of time. In her closet, I shuffled through clothes and shoes, ran my hand along the top shelf. Suddenly, my fingers knocked against something. I stood on my tiptoes and pulled it out. It was an old shoebox, a thick layer of dust across the top. I sat cross-legged on the floor with it on my lap. My heart pounded wildly in my chest. The shower was still going, but I knew I didn't have much time. The box was light. I almost thought it was empty. But when I took the lid off and pushed a layer of tissue paper aside, I saw a thick piece of paper. It was my birth certificate. I looked at the spot where my parents' names were listed, but only my mom's was there. I put it down and lifted out the tissue paper. Underneath was a hospital ID bracelet with my name in pale blue letters. And then I saw it. A small square piece of plain white card, the type you might find in a bunch of flowers delivered to your doorstep. On one side, it was blank. On the other, in thick capital letters, it said, "Sorry, G." The next day, I stayed after school to help Peter with our chemistry homework. Tyler gave me the silent treatment all day, but I just pretended everything was fine. It was the best way to deal with Tyler. Pretend everything was all right, and pretty soon it would be. I didn't really want to go home after that, so I texted Mom and told her I was still studying, then grabbed the late bus to Madison's. I wanted to tell her about the card I'd found and the lies my mom had told. I pulled the hood of my coat up over my head as the mist thickened into rain. Storming down the quiet suburban road toward Madison's house, I passed elegant mock Tudors and Pacific Northwest timber homes and dove into the dripping green pines spread out lush and thick above the zigzag bridge. The zigzag bridge wasn't really a zigzag. It was only called that because the river that ran underneath it twisted back and forth until it reached Puget Sound. When I was a kid, we used to call it the Cinderella Bridge because it looked like something out of a fairy tale. The suspension cables were hung from four silver towers, two at either end, crowned by soaring spires, while the gleaming metal framework was decorated with lacy arches and ornamental railings. I hunched my backpack higher on my shoulders and headed over the bridge, my feet echoing loudly against the wooden slats of the pedestrian walkway. Usually, I took the shortcut from my house through the woods to Madison's instead of looping up and around, walking over a mile along the zigzag road. Mom had made me promise never to take the shortcut. She thought the woods were full of murderers or something, but the paved road took way too long. For her peace of mind, I told her I always went the long way to Madison's. I didn't want to lie to her or anything, but I didn't want her worrying either. Sometimes she could be a bit overprotective. Besides, it wasn't exactly lying, it just wasn't the whole truth. I leaned on the doorbell at Madison's house, my breath coming in short bursts until the door flew open. Madison's brother Derek looked like he'd been face down in a pillow for a really long time. His face was crinkled with sleep, and he blinked his eyes fast, as if the late afternoon light burned his retinas.
"Olivia? What are you doing here?"
His voice was raspy, and he raked one hand through his dark, tousled curls. I stared at Derek, totally speechless. I hadn't seen him in almost 3 years. He looked so different. And by different, I mean really, really hot. Gone was the lanky, awkward teenager I'd known. His chest had filled out, his face slimmed down. He'd grown a few inches and now towered over me. He was wearing skinny black jeans and a fitted black t-shirt that was tight at the biceps. A silvered chain necklace was coiled twice around his neck.
Derek! Hey!
My voice squeaked, and I coughed to cover it.
I forgot you were back from New York.
Sorry about pushing on the doorbell. I thought Madison would answer. The words rushed out of me too fast, and I knew I sounded like a dumb little kid. I was desperate to know whether he'd thought about me while he was away the way I'd thought about him. Last time I'd seen him, I'd declared my undying 14-year-old love. He'd kissed me gently on the cheek and said,
"See you later."
The next day he'd left for New York. I never told Madison about my crush on her brother. She'd hate it. She could be jealous and nasty when it came to Derek. Once I was at their house and I didn't feel well, so I played Nintendo with Derek instead of hide-and-go-seek with her. She went to his room and took all his certificates he'd glued into a scrapbook and shredded every one of them.
"You want to come in?"
Derek asked. I followed him through the dining room into the designer kitchen. The stainless steel shimmered in the afternoon light. An expensive watercolor of trees hung above the mahogany dinner table. I shrugged out of my wet jacket, draping it over a chair. He pulled two bottles of water out of the refrigerator, tossing one to me.
"So?"
I took a sip of my water. "You back for good?"
"Yeah."
"Did you like it?"
He shrugged.
"Well, what was it like?"
I had so many questions, but this new Derek wasn't like the one I'd known 3 years ago. Plus, all the things Madison had told me about him, maybe I was a little bit scared of him.
"It was fine. It's a big city, so it's pretty busy, but yeah, I liked it."
He sounded bored, or maybe annoyed.
"Madison isn't here,"
he added.
"Where is she?"
"Auditioning for some play or something."
I hit my forehead with my hand.
"Oh, yeah, shoot. I forgot about that."
He set his water on the counter.
"So, what's up?"
"Nothing much. Just school and finals, getting ready for senior year and stuff."
"No."
He looked exasperated, like I was the dumbest person ever.
"I meant, why'd you come storming over here?"
I hesitated, not sure I wanted to tell Derek about my mom.
"Did you get in a fight with your boyfriend?"
He smirked. Anger boiled in me, and I clenched my fists. I wasn't used to feeling angry, but I felt like it was leaking from me, set free by the acid of my mom's lies. I couldn't control it, and suddenly it took a new direction. How dare he? The last time I was with him, I'd thought, well, it didn't matter now, but I'd thought we'd shared something special. It was silly, just the slight brush of our arms against each other while watching a movie. A long gaze. It was stupid. I didn't even recognize this new Derek. "I'll come back later. Sorry I bothered you." I put my water bottle on the counter and spun around, heading for the door. Derek stopped me with a hand on my shoulder.
"No, I'm sorry."
The smirk fell off his face, and for the first time since I'd arrived, he looked like the Derek I used to know.
"Honestly, you're not bothering me."
He was so earnest, it reminded me of when we were little kids and I got stuck in the washing machine trying to hide from him during hide-and-seek.
"So, boyfriend problems?"
"No," I snapped. "For your information, my mom lied to me, and I'm really pissed off about it." Derek leaned away, as if blown back by the force of my anger.
Shit, sorry. What about?
When I didn't reply, he headed toward the stairs.
Come on,
he said.
Let's go downstairs.
I hesitated, confused by his quick change of personalities. Maybe he was more like Madison than I'd thought. I followed him to the far side of the kitchen, across the hall, and down the stairs to the basement.
My mom and dad gave me the downstairs. I think they're just hoping I'll disappear down here.
He chuckled, but the laugh didn't quite reach his eyes. Downstairs was more welcoming than upstairs, all blonde wood and worn brown leather. A grunge band blasted on a massive surround sound stereo system. A huge entertainment center and two leather chairs took up one side of the basement, while the other side had an unmade king-size bed. At the back of the room, a hallway led to darkness. He shoved clothes off a leather chair.
Here, sit down.
He picked up a set of remote controls and turned off the stereo, then pressed a button. The ornately carved walnut doors of the entertainment center opened slowly, revealing a huge plasma screen television. He flopped onto the other chair and flicked through the channels until he found a rerun of Family Guy. He looked up at me.
You gonna sit?
Sure. If Madison came home and found me hanging with her brother, she'd totally flip. I perched on the arm of the chair and tugged on the tail of the silver bracelet at my wrist.
So, what'd your mom lie about?
He asked. Well, last week some kids from my school and I were at UW at this thing to get juniors ready for college. We saw this girl, Kendall, and she looked just like me. I'm not even kidding. Everybody said it. Like sisters.
That's weird.
Yeah. So yesterday I asked my mom about my dad. Like, what was he like and did he have any other family? Then I asked her what color eyes he had. She said brown.
So?
First of all, I'm in advanced biology. My mom has blue eyes, so if my dad had brown eyes, it's pretty unlikely I'd have green eyes. Not impossible, but genetically unlikely.
And second?
Second of all, I asked her when I was 13 what color eyes he had, and she said green. And now she said brown.
But why would she tell you two different colors?
I threw my hands up and slid into the chair. She's getting confused with her lies.
And this girl, Kendall, she has green eyes too?
Yeah, and this same chin dimple. I pointed at the cleft in my chin. I googled it. It's genetic, but my mom doesn't have it.
So, Kendall looks a lot like you. She has a chin dimple. She has the same color eyes as you, and now your mom lied about what color your dad's eyes were. And you think what? That you're related to this girl?
Well, yeah. Saying it that way made it sound really stupid.
It seems a bit, you know, Hollywood.
I know, I admitted. But my mom lied to me. We never lie to each other. I chewed my lip. At least, I thought we didn't, I amended. But now I'm wondering what else she's lied about, and I pulled the piece of white card out of my back pocket. I found this in her room. It was in a shoebox in her closet. I held it out to Derek, and he read the text.
Sorry. Sorry for what?
I don't know. But it was with my birth certificate. It must have something to do with me.
Have you looked her up on Facebook?
My mom?
No, Kendall.
I shook my head. The thought hadn't even crossed my mind.
Well, did you ask her who her father is? Find out his name?
I didn't think of any of that stuff when I met her. Derek grabbed a shiny silver MacBook from his bedside table. He brought it back to the chair, flipped the lid up, and opened Facebook.
"Do you want to look?"
Derek asked. Madison said I was a doormat. Mom said I let Madison walk all over me. Maybe they were both right. Maybe it was time I stood up and did something for myself. I nodded. "Yeah, okay." I leaned over his shoulder and typed in my login details, aware of how close we were. He smelled just faintly of pine trees and the clean, soapy smell of shaving cream. Kendall Montgomery's page popped up right away. In her profile picture, she was pouting, her eyes creased as if she was about to smile. I didn't want to know her. And yet I did.
"Holy shit."
Derek's eyes popped open wide.
"She does look just like you."
"I know. It's creepy. What should I do?"
"What do you want to do?"
I was surprised. Most people never asked me what I wanted. I usually just went along for the ride. I looked into Derek's midnight blue eyes. Something in them made me feel safe enough to find out things I should probably leave alone. I leaned over him and pressed add friend. "I want to talk to her," I said.
Chapter 8. Abby. October. The sound of Tyler's feet thumping down the front steps jolted me out of my stunned trance. "Wait!" I flung myself out the open front door and into the rain, crashing into the driver's door of his Jeep as the engine roomed to life. A flash went off from my front yard, but I ignored it. "Wait!" I smacked my open palm against Tyler's door. Tyler rolled the window down, his eyebrows drawn together. His eyes flicked up to the reporters watching our exchange. "What do you mean?" I hissed, so only he could hear. "Saved her from everything?" He glared at me, but kept his voice down also. "You had all these rules. You controlled her. She said you were writing the script for her life, and she was sick of it. If you weren't trying to run her life, maybe she wouldn't have done stupid things." My finger slipped off the edge of the window, and I stumbled backward, propelled by the vitriol of his words. Tyler reversed out of the driveway quickly, his wheels skidding in the gravel. Another flash went off near me. I turned my face to my shoulder and raised my hand as if I could ward it off. God only knew what the reporters would write about this. I looked like a lunatic, my blonde hair a nest of damp tangles sticking up in every direction, the scent of alcohol on my breath. I looked up as I heard the crunch of tires on the gravel. Two police detectives, badges clipped to their belts, got out of the car.
"All right, guys, get out of here. You know the rules. Get off her property now," the male detective said.
He was squarely built, with short legs and a squat body. Dark circles were etched beneath watery blue eyes that appraised me from under thick eyebrows. His wrinkled black suit covered an equally wrinkled blue shirt and tie. His thinning hair was a mess, as if he'd only just woken. Just behind him, the female detective waved a reporter, edging closer to my house back to the road. She was a complete contrast to him. Crisp black business suit, starched white collar. She was tall as an Amazon, with cropped, pale blonde hair, a chiseled jaw, and ice blue eyes. Her face was completely blank, the picture of professional detachment. Once the reporters were a safe distance away, they crossed the grass to me.
"Abigail Knight," the man said, extending his hand to shake mine.
"Yes?"
"I'm Detective Philip McNally, and this is Detective James Sampson."
He jerked a thumb over his shoulder. Sampson gave me a brief, firm handshake. Her hands were warm and large, making mine feel small and childish in comparison.
"We'd like to speak with you about your daughter's accident."
"Can we come inside?" McNally asked. I stared at them, blinking. Accident? Why did they think they were here if it was an accident?
Yes, come in.
I led them inside and shut the door, then stood awkwardly in the living room for a minute. I couldn't immediately recall what I was supposed to do.
Would you like a drink?
I finally asked.
No, we're good, Detective McNally said. Can we sit?
Of course. I showed them to the couch and sank onto the recliner.
We're very sorry for what's happened to your daughter, Detective McNally said.
He blinked slowly, as if trying to wake himself up.
Also for the delay. We've only just been alerted to what happened by a...
He glanced down at his notepad.
Dr. Griffith. I know this must be a difficult time for you, but we'd like to take an official statement. Is now okay?
Yes, of course. He pulled a pen from a pocket on the inside of his coat.
Let's start with that last night you saw Olivia. Can you tell me what happened?
My eyes flicked to Detective Sampson's face, but she didn't say a word. My hands shook, and I pressed them under my thighs. I wanted my daughter. I missed her so much it was physical, like scraping cotton wool over an acid burn. I started at the beginning, telling them about our Saturday. Work, homework, the barbecue.
Did everything seem normal?
Detective McNally asked.
Yes. I mean, except, well, she got a haircut.
A haircut?
McNally echoed. I could see he thought grief had driven me a little bit crazy.
Yes, it was unusual.
Unusual how?
Olivia's sensible. She doesn't drink. She's on the swim team, and she gets straight A's. She never does stupid teenager stuff like walk home alone in the dark or sneak out at night to go drinking. It was just weird that she suddenly cut all her hair off. But teenagers do these things, right?
Sometimes. He didn't look at me, just kept staring at his notepad. Is there anybody else who didn't like her or had a grudge against her?
No, I said, shocked. Everybody likes Olivia. I'm not just saying that. Last year at school, she was voted most likable. She was homecoming queen. She's happy and popular and...
My voice broke, and for a second I couldn't continue. Both detectives nodded, their heads moving up and down like bobblehead dolls.
Do you think...
We don't think anything yet.
Detective Sampson cut me off. It was the first time she'd spoken, and it startled me.
We're just building a picture, gathering evidence. Something happened. She has bruises. Do you have any reason to think anybody would hurt Olivia?
McNally asked, his eyebrows raised. I stared at him, dismayed. They'd been here 10 minutes, and already they didn't believe me. McNally continued asking me questions. Who were her friends? Her boyfriend? Had they had any problems? Had she ever tried to harm herself? Had anybody ever tried to hurt her? Had she been having problems at home, at school?
Occasionally, he'd jot something down. The longer we sat there, the more unsettled I felt. Sampson barely said a word, and McNally was the picture of a frazzled, overworked cop. How would these two find out what had happened to my daughter?
I showed them upstairs, and the detective searched Olivia's room, put random items into little plastic bags. They took her laptop and some of her school notebooks, asked me more questions. By the end, my neck ached from carrying the weight of my pounding head. I wanted everything to go back to the way it was. I wanted my daughter back.
Did you find her bracelet?
I asked Detective Sampson. Her brow creased.
A silver charm bracelet. Olivia always wore it, always, but it wasn't on her wrist.
I brushed a hand over my eyes.
No, we didn't find it, but I'll check again.
Was Olivia with anyone that night? Drinking with friends? Detective McNally asked. Neither of them had bothered to sit down after searching Olivia's room. They towered over me in the living room, and my toes curled at the invasion of my personal space.
What? No,
I replied, startled. Olivia wasn't a drinker. All her friends were at the barbecue, and she doesn't... Then I remembered the scarf. her haircut, her pregnancy. Bile, thick and acidic, rose in my throat. I jumped up and raced to the bathroom, slamming open the toilet lid just in time to heave up every last drop of vodka, retching again and again into the white porcelain bowl. Afterward, I shut the toilet seat and rested my head on the lid. I closed my eyes and breathed deeply. The insides of my eyelids were red. I was sweating, hot moisture covering my entire body. I shoved Olivia's phone into the back pocket of my jeans and stripped off my hoodie, tossing it on the floor. When I opened my eyes, I saw a slip of white plastic sticking up from the mess of tissues in the trash can. I sat up slowly, reaching for it. It was a pregnancy test. A pink plus sign practically glowed on the end. Olivia knew she was pregnant, and she hadn't told me. The knowledge was raw inside me, jagged as a broken window pane. As scared as I was when I found out I was pregnant, at least I'd had Sarah. Memories of the day I'd told Sarah I was pregnant bubbled in my mind like a pot of water boiling over. "Do you know who the father is?" Sarah had asked. The old mattress sagged under her weight as she sat next to me on the edge of my bed. "Yes," I snapped. Okay, maybe I used to sleep around a bit. I used sex as a way to get guys to like me. I drank and dabbled in drugs and stayed out late smoking and partying. But it wasn't going to be like that anymore. "Have you told him?" "Of course." "And?" I looked away, and Sarah sighed heavily. "He doesn't want to be in the picture," she stated. I didn't answer. The worst part was that he'd cemented everything I felt all over again, that everybody eventually left me. Sarah slapped her hands on her legs and stood. "I'll come with you to sort it out." I stared at her, horrified. "Are you telling me to get an abortion?" Sarah looked confused. "Of course not. This is my baby. I won't abandon it. I'm nothing like..." I didn't have to finish the sentence. We both knew the ending. Mom had abandoned me, and I had been powerless to stop her. Sarah's face softened, and she sat back down. "Abs, of course you're nothing like her. But a baby? You can't..." Her voice trailed away, and she searched my face. That was exactly what he had said, right before he threatened to hurt my baby and me if anybody found out it was his. So I'd gone to the abortion clinic, and was going to do it. But I couldn't go through with it. Being abandoned was my life's greatest fear. I couldn't do it to my own baby. I looked around at the tiny storeroom I'd used as a bedroom in Sarah's apartment since I was 10. A baby wouldn't fit here, but I had a way to get out now. Maybe I shouldn't have taken it, but I wanted my baby to have everything I never did. A stable home, a solid middle-class upbringing, good opportunities. "I've registered at Valley," I said, referring to the local community college. "I'll get a certificate in journalism. I like writing and I'm good at it. I can get a job at a newspaper." Sarah looked surprised. I was usually more of a joiner than a planner. She struggled with words for a minute, but I knew she'd give in. She was the only parent figure I'd had for most of my life, and she was nothing if not supportive. Finally, she said, "You know I'm here for you, whatever you decide." "Thanks, Sarah." I leaned into my big sister, and she put her arms around me. She brushed my hair off my forehead, and I pulled away, getting up and crossing to look out the window at the Christmas lights stringing the neighborhood. I hated it when she did things my mom used to do. I'd looked down at my stomach, the first hint of a bump pushing out from my sweater, and imagined my baby curled under my heart. I would have someone to be with me no matter what. I'd love her more than I'd ever been loved. In the bathroom, I stood shakily and splashed cold water on my face to help the memories fade. I grabbed Olivia's pregnancy test and took it to Detective Sampson in the living room. For a second, her professional mask slipped, and I thought I saw compassion flare in her eyes, but it was gone as quickly as it had appeared. She pulled a plastic bag from her pocket, then zipped the proof of my grandchild away inside. I don't know if Olivia was with anyone that last night, I said, sinking back into the recliner. I didn't know she was pregnant. She didn't tell me. The admission scraped like razor blades across my raw, aching throat. Neither detective spoke for a minute, but when I looked up, I saw them exchange a look. Well, McNally stood and moved toward the door. That's all we need for now. We'll be in touch if we have any other questions.
Wait! I sprang to my feet and put a hand out. The bruises, her bracelet. Are you going to investigate?
McNally sighed, and I wanted to scream.
We're still in the early stages, he said.
But he wasn't looking at me anymore.
We'll speak to witnesses, process the scene, analyze the bruises.
Both detectives moved toward the door. But at the last second, Sampson turned and spoke.
We're very sorry for your loss. We'll be in touch. Keep you up to date if we can find anything new.
She slid a business card into my palm.
Call me anytime. And Miss Knight, just ignore the reporters. They'll go away in a few days.
I stood frozen in place, the front door flapping in the increasing wind, and watched as they got in their unmarked police car and drove slowly away. I hunched my shoulders against the cold and shoved my hands into the back pockets of my jeans. My fingers knocked against something hard. They hadn't asked for Olivia's phone. Chapter 9. Abby. November. November arrived abruptly in Portage Point. The sky was gray and wet. The wind tossed leaves across the ground in angry flurries. I scurried across the parking lot toward the hospital. By the time I reached the front, my hair clung to my forehead in damp tendrils. Inside, I headed for the elevators while dialing the numbers on the business card Samson had left me. It was the third time that day, but still it went to voicemail. I knew there were budget cuts. I knew other cases were important, too, that the investigative process took time. But surely, surely Olivia's case would take priority. Even on the rare occasion when a detective answered, they just told me to be patient. They'd let me know if anything new came up. They were always fobbing me off like that. And I didn't have time for it. 4 weeks had passed since Olivia's fall. Only 14 weeks until the baby would be born. And that was if we were lucky. I needed answers sooner, not later. I took the elevator to the floor Olivia had been moved to last week. Now that she was out of the ICU, the baby had a better chance at surviving. But seeing the ventilator and feeding tube was no less of a shock each time I arrived. I steeled myself against the pain and pushed open the door. Sarah was slumped over the edge of Olivia's bed. Her mouth hung open in sleep, a deep crease denting the middle of her forehead.
Sarah,
I whispered. My sister jumped when I touched her shoulder. You should go home. Go see Dylan and Brad. She rubbed her arm over her eyes.
I couldn't sleep. What time is it?
6.
They're sleeping.
You should be too. I put my purse down and slipped out of my coat, sitting in the chair next to her as the pale light edged the darkness from the room. I picked up Olivia's hand and inspected her wrist. The bruises had faded, the broken skin mostly healed. Her skin renewed itself, even though her brain never would. I'm thinking of going back to work, I told Sarah. I realized with some surprise that I missed the rhythm of my job. The predictability. At least I knew what I was doing in accounting, what to expect. There was no guesswork, only right or wrong. Right now, I was just waiting through my days. But for what? The police rarely responded to my calls. Olivia's case was still open, but it felt like they weren't really investigating. The last 4 weeks had passed in a slow, nauseating spin. I slept and ate little, sobbed a lot. I shoved fistfuls of sedatives in my mouth, washing them down with red wine and vodka until I'd drunk everything in my house and had no pills left to take. The dull lethargy that had plagued me immediately after Olivia fell was being replaced by a crazed adrenaline and an urge to know the truth. People throughout Portage Point had heard the news. They wanted to ask questions, to know what had happened. But I had no answers and no energy to explain that the police had yet to piece together any intelligible reason for Olivia's fall. At least Samson had been right about the reporters. They'd eventually trickled away in search of more urgent stories. The cost of caring for Olivia was mounting. My insurance was already balking, and I knew I'd have to find a way to pay for everything for another 3 months at least. And then there was the baby. "I can't lose my insurance," I said. Sarah nodded. She, of all people, knew that the weight of unexpected responsibility could be as heavy as water. I looked at Olivia in the hospital bed, a pale, shriveled version of herself, eyes closed, intubated. The incessant, mechanized hush of the machines keeping her alive. "I don't understand why the police aren't working harder on this," I said, anger and frustration simmering inside me. "I'm sure they are," Sarah reassured me. She stood and rolled her neck in slow circles. "Investigations take time. They said the bruises were probably from the fall. But you saw them, right? They were fingerprints. Somebody did this to her." Sarah looked away, and I could tell she didn't really agree. I didn't like everything I said, second-guessed, my emotions and my sanity questioned. I knew what I'd seen. I just had no way to prove it meant what I thought it did. "They're still investigating," she repeated. "We have to let them do their job." I glared at her. "I know you don't understand, but I need to know what happened." Flames of anger curled in my stomach, and the air between us tightened. After our mother died, it was me who acted out and raged. Sarah had stayed calm and composed. She'd organized the funeral, taken care of the will, boxed up all my things, and moved me in with her. I was a basket case in comparison. I wailed and wept, wanted to know why Mom was dead, who I could blame. When I didn't get answers, I wallowed, sinking into the grief and letting it hold me like a warm bath. That's what losing your only parent when you're 10 does. It makes it so you can't ever let go. Sarah didn't want to talk about Mom at all. She wasn't interested in remembering and certainly didn't want me talking about that day. Her emotionless, brisk efficiency made me doubt my feelings. I wondered why I cared so much, but she didn't. Over time, I'd learned to hide my emotions. But on the inside, I was still just a wreck, barely keeping it together. "Of course I understand," Sarah said, her forehead creasing with hurt. "I get it. I want to help. I know people at the Seattle Police Department through work. I'll call around, see if anybody there can help." "I don't need a shrink picking my brain apart." I gritted my teeth. "I need to know what happened to Olivia. Besides, I can't pay for it. I don't mean a counselor, and I don't mean in an official capacity, just as a favor. Maybe they can ask around, get some insight into what the Portage Point police are doing, what they're thinking." My pulse raced through my clenched muscles. I looked away, wanting her to stop talking. "The baby's doing well," she said, changing the subject. She reached over and touched Olivia's stomach. Somehow, despite so many tests, drugs, and x-rays, the baby was healthy. It was growing at a normal rate, swimming in the space beneath where my daughter's heart pumped blood around her body. I dug my fingernails into the skin of my upper arms until they left pale, moon-shaped dents, then raked them across my upper arms, scratching at the invisible itch. The pain was sharp, intense, but in a way that felt good. "Abby, stop!" Sarah exclaimed, her voice sharp as a ragged hangnail. "Then stop talking about the baby." "Why?" Her brow puckered. "Don't you get it?" I exploded. The spark of anger, lit and consumed my insides, suddenly so bulky that I couldn't sit still. I launched out of my chair and crossed the room to stare out the window. The maple trees that lined the park across the street were nearly bare, slowly losing the last of their crimson and gold leaves. "Get what?" I whirled to face her. "When the baby's born, Olivia will die. So stop harping on about the baby, because that deadline means my daughter fucking dies." I didn't wait for her reply. I pushed past her and ran out the door, down the stairs, back into the driving rain. Back at home, I felt a deep, dark self-loathing stealing over me. I shouldn't have blown up at Sarah. Whatever problems I'd had with my sister, whatever resentment I'd held in my heart, Sarah had always been my rock. Even when my mom was alive, it was Sarah my teachers called if I was sick. Sarah who helped me with my homework. When I was 5 and got lost when we were picnicking at the beach, it was Sarah I howled for under the hot, white sun. I was alone and she ran to me, shouting my name, and I knew I was safe. I never felt that way with my mom. A sudden vivid memory of my mother the day she died flashed through me. The blood, the screaming. Was it Sarah or me? The gun still hanging from her finger. I'd lost my mother and my childhood in one cruel day. I guess being angry and blaming Sarah was easier than moving on. Fuck. I scrubbed my hands over my eyes. I was such a mess. I crossed the living room to the small oak desk in the corner next to the fireplace and sat down. Once my old laptop had booted up, I opened my email, prepared to send a request for another leave of absence to my boss. I had 34 new emails, a mix of junk mail, persistent interview requests, well-wishers at work, friends and acquaintances in the community who were too scared to talk to me face to face. And then my eye fell on something else. Your invoice from Apple. Invoice Apple ID, OliviaLouiseKnight@gmail.com. Tears sprang to my eyes. It was yet another reminder that Olivia wasn't here anymore. I didn't need to pay this bill anymore. But I didn't want to stop because that would be an admission that my daughter wasn't coming back. I wanted to drop my head to the desk and let my broken heart overwhelm me. Instead, I took a deep breath and typed iCloud.com into the browser. I logged in with her email and password, which I'd insisted she give me when I bought us both the iPhones, and a number of brightly colored icons filled my screen. Email, contacts, calendar, photos. The guts of Olivia's life were here. I clicked the mail icon, but the mailbox was empty except for a welcome email. I shut it and moved on to contacts. There were hundreds of people listed. Some I knew, but a lot I didn't. I scrolled slowly down the page, staring hard at each name. Who were they? Had one of these people hurt Olivia? Next, I opened photos. At first, I didn't understand what I was seeing. Horror stole over me like a mist, uncurling deep within. And then a fiery knot began to burn in my stomach. I squeezed my eyes tightly shut, then opened them again. The pictures were still there. The first one was slightly blurry, as if it had been zoomed in from far away. Olivia was standing outside her school, staring at something in the distance. Somebody had drawn devil horns over her head, and a red line across her throat with what looked like drops of blood below. "Die, bitch," was written across the bottom. In the second one, Olivia's face was colored over in hard, angry scribbles, a red noose twisted around her throat. But I could tell it was Olivia by the clothes she wore, her favorite swim team shirt. I leaned closer to read the red text. "Kill." And another. A knife drawn plunged into Olivia's heart, blood dripping down her chest. The words, "You die," were scrawled on the picture. Shock rippled through me. There were a handful more, all variations of the first three. Pictures of Olivia with her neck slit, blood dripping down the image, her eyes whited out, bloody intestines vomiting from her mouth, all with die, kill, and fuck you scribbled across them. Oh my God, I whispered. A rush of adrenaline thumped hot and silent in my blood. Someone had been cyberbullying Olivia. Chapter 10. Abby. November. I started to shake all over, a shocked and angry vibration that started at the very core of me and radiated out. Why would somebody send these to Olivia? And who? I scrolled down through the rest of the photos, but there was nothing else there, nothing threatening anyway. I rested my head on the desk and thumped it softly against the edge, as if that would knock loose rational thoughts that might solve this puzzle. Think, Abby, think. Her phone. I bolted upright. Maybe there were more on her actual phone. I racked my mind, trying to think where I'd put it. I barely remembered what had happened since Olivia fell. It felt like I'd been sleepwalking since then. I ran to the kitchen and grabbed Olivia's phone from the counter I'd thrown it on after the detectives left. The fact that the police hadn't even asked for or looked for Olivia's cell was further proof they weren't taking the investigation seriously. I plugged the phone into charge, and after a few seconds, it chimed and burst to life. There were two unread text messages. The most recent was from someone Olivia had saved as Kay at 10:42 a.m. later the same morning Olivia was found. You okay? I'm so sorry. I seriously didn't know. Anyway, he's a dick. If you're like me, you'll cut him out for good. I brushed a hand over my face, more baffled than ever. I scrolled down and read the other text. It was from Tyler. At 11:20 p.m., the night Olivia fell. I scrolled up to read the whole thread. Olivia, you're right. We need to talk. You still at barbecue? Meet in 15? Tyler, yep. See you in a few. I paused, letting the part of my brain that allowed me to analyze numbers so well take over. I latched on to something as my mind anchored and examined it. The thought crystallized into something cold and hard. Fuck, I whispered out loud. Tyler had told me Olivia left at 10:45 p.m., and he hadn't seen her after that. But according to this text, they'd met up at around 11:30 p.m. Tyler lied to me. I scrolled back through some of Olivia's old texts. The most recent ones were from Kay and a string of texts from somebody called Only D. As I read, I realized they were sweet, some rather romantic, and I remembered Tyler telling me the baby wasn't his. Perhaps this D was the baby's father. The shock of finding the disturbing images in Olivia's iCloud account and the texts from Tyler had begun to dissipate, leaving behind a completely clear view. This was the proof I needed. Somebody had hurt Olivia on purpose. I had to go to the police. The Portage Point Police Department was situated in a miniature antebellum-style brick building on the far side of town, nestled under tall pine trees and fronted by a series of low boxwood shrubs. I drove too quickly up Main Street, flying past the white steepled church, a handful of indie coffee shops, a yoga studio, and the small town square, then turned right past a children's playground and baseball diamond. I parked outside the station, between a police SUV and an American flag, flapping aggressively in the wind. Carol Ann, the police station receptionist, recognized me as soon as I walked in. Abby! She came around the desk and reached for me, folding me against her massive, doughy bosom. She smelled of lavender and soap, which made me suddenly aware of how long it had been since I'd showered. When Carol Ann pulled away, her soft brown eyes sparkled with tears. Carol Ann was like the police department's built-in grandma, complete with thick glasses and permed graying hair that poofed around her face. She'd run the front office as long as I could remember, helping the town's 4 police officers and 2 detectives organize legal paperwork, answer the phones, and comfort victims. "Carol Ann, I need to see Detective Sampson or McNally. Are they here?" I took a step toward the half-open inner door and caught a glimpse of Sampson sitting in a small kitchen, a sandwich in front of her as she stared at her cell phone. The murmur of police radios floated out to me. Carol Ann stepped in front of me and put her hand on my elbow, gently guiding me to a chair by her desk. "Let me see if they're free. I'll be right back." A few minutes later, she returned with Detective Sampson. I jumped up, anger flaring in me. "Where have you been?" I snapped. "I've left 1,000 messages for you guys and nothing. No wonder you haven't solved Olivia's case if you're sitting here eating lunch and checking your phone all day." Sampson's ice-blue eyes flashed something I couldn't immediately recognize. Not anger, exactly. Surprise. She nodded at Carol Ann, then jerked her head toward the door. "Please, come with me." I followed her down the hallway, past the kitchen, to a characterless room painted a cold gray. There were no pictures on the walls, no decorations, nothing except a window to the hallway with half-closed blinds and a table like the kind you'd find in a cafeteria with a handful of folding chairs around it. I pulled Olivia's phone out of my purse, set it on the table with a loud thunk, then glared at her as she sat down. "You didn't take Olivia's phone." Sampson crossed one leg over her knee and studied me for a long minute. "Didn't Detective McNally ask you for it?" "No." I started to shake my head, then stopped. I couldn't actually remember. "I don't think so." "We are pursuing a number of leads, Miss Knight." I gritted my teeth, knowing that was code for, "We haven't found anything." "Olivia's boyfriend, Tyler? He lied to me. He told me they didn't see each other after she left the barbecue. But there's a text here." I clicked into the text thread and handed the phone to her. "See? She says she's going back to the barbecue. She would have met him at 11:30 and... I dug in my purse for the threatening pictures I'd printed from Olivia's iCloud account and laid them on the table. "Somebody sent her these." Sampson scrolled through the phone for a moment, then picked up the pictures, her face a cold, hard mask. She studied them for a long moment. "Were these on her phone?" I shook my head. "No, they were in her iCloud account, which was synced with her phone. They must have been deleted from her phone." "Any idea who sent these?" "No, none at all." Sampson leaned forward and handed me her notebook and a pen. "Can you write down her login details for me?" I did, then started to ask if she believed me now, but a knock at the door interrupted me. McNally's head poked in, his flabby jowls stretched into what I assumed was meant to be a smile. He looked as exhausted and unkempt as usual, but this time there was something else I hadn't noticed before, an unmistakable edge of animosity. "If I could just borrow Detective Sampson for a minute?" Sampson carefully folded the printed pages and slipped them into her blazer pocket, along with Olivia's phone and her notebook. The door closed with a sharp snap behind her. I sat on one of the metal chairs and watched them through the slats of the cheap metal blinds. I couldn't hear what they were saying. McNally was speaking forcefully to Sampson. He looked angry. Sampson gestured with both hands, more animated than normal. She lifted Olivia's phone, but he shook his head and batted it away. Sampson glanced at me, gave me a small, tight smile, but something tilted inside of me when I saw it. I felt a sense of foreboding, of time running out. And right then, I knew, with a dark certainty, that if I left it to them, I would never know the truth about what had happened to Olivia. I'd spent my whole life hiding, just existing behind the walls I'd built around myself. I never got the answers I needed when my mother died. I was powerless to stop my mom killing herself. Powerless to make Olivia's father choose me. Powerless to stop my daughter from. The pain of reality hit me in the stomach. But I couldn't afford to feel that way now. Self-pity was fine when you were 10, but in a few months I'd have Olivia's baby to take care of. Wallowing was an indulgence I didn't have. I needed answers now. What do you do when you know something and nobody will listen? When you need answers and nobody will provide them? When you can't trust anybody to help you? I stood at a crossroads, half aware that my choice now would send me down a path from which there would be no turning back. The decision wasn't a hard one. I didn't want to be powerless anymore. I wanted answers. I slammed the interview room door open, and Sampson and McNally turned to me, eyes wide with surprise. "Something's wrong," I said, a crazed fury surging through my body. Rage had hijacked the rational part of my brain, the part that never stood up to people, that sat back while others told me what to do. "I know something's wrong, and you both know it. Whether you help me or not, I'm going to find out what happened to my daughter."
Chapter 11. Olivia. May. "Do you guys want to go to Java Cafe?" Madison raised her voice to be heard over the racket of teenagers spilling into the hall. With its exposed brick walls and mismatched array of cushy couches, Java Cafe was our usual hangout. It was one of the first really hot days of the year, and everybody was either going there or heading for the beach. "I'm